This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. I'm Julie Rose. It's our weekly director's cut of the show. First, how older workers can get their careers back on track post-pandemic. Then, why some sharks are so mysterious, scientists call them ghost sharks. Also, many of our casual acquaintances got left behind during the pandemic. Is it worth the trouble to revive them? That's ahead on Top of Mind Prime Cuts. Thanks for tuning in. There are more job openings right now in the United States than there are people seeking work. And there is a mismatch between the jobs companies need to fill and the kinds of jobs people want or have the experience for. Author Fawn Germer says older job seekers she's interviewed are especially worried about their careers dying in the post-pandemic economy. Will they manage to find another job of similar responsibility or salary? If there are no more jobs like that, how do they invent a new career for themselves this late in the game? Germer is a motivational speaker, and her latest book is Coming Back: How to Win the Job You Want When You've Lost the Job You Need. I spoke with her back in January. Let's listen. So I said older workers, which I think makes people think of someone in their late 50s or 60s.
45. 45 is old. And there's one other category, a couple other categories that are in the same boat, which is people who stay home to raise their children, male or female, or people who take time out to care for loved ones or just travel for a few years. They're all in the same tough boat.
How can somebody who's 45, my age, be considered like past their prime in terms of their work life? I thought this was the age where you were at the top of your game. You've finally climbed the ladder to the executive suite.
Oh, girlfriend, if only we had known. Actually, for women, we reach that pinnacle allegedly at age 40. That's when we reach our peak earning capacity. Now, I never got that memo that said it was going to go downhill after that. And actually didn't, but eventually you hit some walls. And the thing is that these fresh graduates are coming out of school so technologically agile and with fresh, innovative ideas, then they work for less money. And so more output, less money equals more value to the employer. And then as the millennials did what they were doing, which is delivering, they started rising up through the ranks and they're doing the hiring and they like their own. Part of that is because people, late Gen Xers, baby boomers, weren't so nice to the millennials when they got to the workplace. They just thought, oh, they don't even know their place. They want everything right now and it's their rules. And they don't know that you don't march into that person's office and demand things. And so there was this generational clash, but the millennials delivered. And so over time, they started getting more authority and influence. And now that's where the game is.
So the problem is that the young people are in charge now and they just don't want to work with older folks anymore?
In some cases, but there still are older people in charge. The problem is that as technology started to advance and then it started going faster and faster and faster, so many people stopped aggressively learning. They might have taken their training to get what knowledge they needed to use current technology, but they were not well versed in what was coming, if at all. So, you know, they do social media kind of sort of. And they might have known that the letter A plus the letter I equals artificial intelligence, but they may not know what it means to their industry. And they resisted things like when in retail, imagine resisting online retail, right? And saying that's never going to work. But then it did. So everything changed and they didn't lead the change. And the problem being, if you've been there longer, you have a bigger paycheck. And if you've got a bigger paycheck, you have to justify that you're doing way more than the people who are doing it for less. Well, if you haven't kept up, you haven't made that justification. The good thing is you can get caught up. And I have to say that very clearly because it seems overwhelming and depressing. If you get that sense that something's been going on and you've missed it, it just seems like you'll never catch up, but you can. And I talk about that a lot in my book, Coming Back, because there is a way to come back. You just have to make the aggressive effort for a few months to get caught up and then go beyond.
You interviewed hundreds of people in the course of this book, collected a lot of grim stories and some encouraging ones. Tell us about someone that you spoke with who got caught unawares, missed the boat, and now, you know, now it's do or die for them in terms of trying to get their career back on track or keep a career. And they've still got, you know, 15, 20 years left to work.
Well, yeah, there are two things that people like that do is that they have to either get caught up or they have to find a company that's living in the past. Mm-hmm. And those companies still exist. There, you might see certain smaller companies or family owned where they just aren't going to keep pace with certain things. So they may find a home there. But I remember one woman that I interviewed had hit the wall, and she said she applied for more than 600 jobs and never cut through, but then admitted her shortcomings and started doing what I said, which is take these online classes at either Coursera or edX.org. I love those two the most because you can learn from professors at Harvard or Yale or Cambridge or Berkeley or BYU. All of these schools have professors doing this online learning and the classes are free. So you might take a 20-hour class in artificial intelligence. And the beauty of that is you already have your degree, so you don't have to get an A in it. You just need the knowledge. So she took a bunch of free classes and she started reading the things I said. You have to always be checking Wall Street Journal, Harvard Business Review, things like Inc., in Fast Company. So you know what's going on. And then you are able to converse in relevance. And that makes you viable because a lot of people, if they've left the workplace or if they are older, think that just because they did a great job, they are so valuable because they have experience. Mm. But a lot of hiring agents roll their eyes at you using that as justification for your job.
Experience, you're not supposed to play up your experience. That can actually backfire.
Right. You get that hashtag of has been. Now, there's a moment when it does come into play. But before you bring up what you did for 20 or 30 years, show what you're doing right now so that you show that you're current, you're relevant, you've taken these classes, you've got ideas because you've studied trends in your industry and you know how to innovate the path forward. See, you don't have to be a computer programmer. If we had to do that, most of us would fail. You have to know what the technology is and what it can do. And if you're Googling the right things, you'll learn it.
Okay, so, I mean, well, help me understand how that looks, say, in a job interview. You have to go in proving at every moment your relevance.
Your relevance in that you've got a cool factor. You can't go in there looking like some sloppy, frumpy older person whose day has come and gone. You have to show you've got it going on. And I kept hearing these people telling me things off the record. And, you know, I interviewed a lot of CEOs and senior executives. And none of them is going to say on the record, man, if you're like a frumpy, fat person, you're not going to get hired. But off the record, they started saying things that were offensive to me because, you know, I've had a lifelong weight issue and you hear the judgments that they make and realize these are real. So even if you are big, you can look cool and that's what it is. And so I remember I did this one interview and somebody really did a blistering thing about frumpy people. And I remember I went over to the mirror and I looked and I'm like, dang, you look a little frumpy yourself. So I had to do my own makeover and it's not that hard and it's not that expensive, but you want to just show that you're current, that your best days are ahead of you. And that's a big point of my book, which is not just to say you may be behind, but to say, what if your greatest success hasn't even happened yet? And I believe that if we just keep taking one step and then the next and fight through this adversity, we can create our biggest success. I feel that with every bone in my body. I could not be more excited about my career. And I know there's better stuff coming in front of me. And way to go, me. You know, it's like I didn't give up. And so many people get the negative message. There's no opportunity. There's age discrimination. You're never going to get hired. And because they put that poison in their head, there is no opportunity and they're never going to get hired. But if instead you take charge of that negativity and say, some people break through, I need to do what it takes to be one of the few who makes it. And you can do that because most people aren't doing anything except complaining.
What are, Von Germer, what are some of the subtle ways that a person over 40 might be undermining themselves in a job interview with someone who's younger?
Oh, yeah. I remember something that happened back when I was at IBM 20 years ago. Or I like this one. I've got a grandson that's your age. Or my son is your age, right? It's like, don't highlight that. They already are doing things to figure out how old you are when they say, when did you graduate high school? And you have to figure out how you're going to answer that. But the biggest thing you have to do in all of this is have such a good network that these people are expecting somebody extraordinary as you're going in there. And I talk a lot about how to build that network and leverage it. And everybody's like, well, you can't do that during COVID. Mm-hmm. And there has never been a better time to network than during COVID.
What do you
mean? Because, well, everybody's at home doing nothing, right? And they're bored. Yeah, and you know, we all got a little tired sitting in the driveway having our wine. And even us down here in Florida, it's like, yeah, I can't do that one again. So that if you do your networking properly, you identify the company where you want to work on LinkedIn, start identifying some key leaders there, add them, and then comment on what they are sharing so they get familiar with your name. And then you say, I've been interested in your company. Would you possibly do 15 minutes of coffee and mentoring for me? I'm not going to ask you for any favors. I just need some ideas. And people will do things to help you. And if somebody says no, number one, karma. Two, somebody else will say yes. So you just go to the next person. I've had people tell me no, but I've had a whole lot more tell me yes. And then when it comes time and you know what it is you want exactly, you leverage that connection by specifically saying, I'm interested in this position. So-and-so is doing the hiring. Can you please talk to this person about me and then make that connection electronically so I can continue the conversation? And when you ask for that, you just send an email and the subject should be personal favor, because we do a really lousy job of using our networks. We do a fairly good job usually of building a network, but it's usually useless. And you don't want to say, hey, do you mind circulating my resume or do you know of anything? That's not going to help you. You do your research and say exactly what you want. And also, I say this every day, when you're networking somebody, connect with them on a human level. So if you want to network with me, it's much more important that you know that I am a passionate kayaker who has a pit bull and still watches Grey's Anatomy after 17 years, than it is that you know that I'm a best-selling Oprah author and speaker, right? It doesn't matter what I do. It's who I am that you want to connect with. So people who connect with me on those things tend to wind up in my network. So find something personal about the person, and you're not just making a professional contact, but a personal connection.
I'm speaking with Von Germer. She is a leadership speaker and author. Her latest book is called Coming Back, How to Win the Job You Want When You've Lost the Job You Need. If you are someone who has lost your job because of a layoff, or you had to leave temporarily to take care of an aging loved one or kids, whatever, and now you are trying to get back into the workforce and you're interviewing for jobs that you know darn well, I mean, they pay less. They're less prestigious than what you were doing before your break. And the person in the room knows that, the person that you're that's interviewing you. How do you go into an interview like that and really be convincing that this is, you know, that you're willing to take less money and less responsibility because you're looking to recharge or redirect your career?
Well, a certain amount of it, I mean, come on, we're lying. We want the same amount of money and we want the same position. Unfortunately, careers never are a straight shot to the top. And I need to say that twice. It's not a straight shot to the top. So don't take it personally when you get kicked in the teeth. That's how it goes. It's up, it's down, it's back and forth. Sooner or later, you get where you need to go. So when these people are suspect, they've got a right to be suspect. But what you do is show that you've really researched the company and say, I'm so glad you were honest about bringing that up, because I can understand why you'd make that assumption. Truth is, I'm looking for a job. I'm passionate about your company. I've studied it. I want to work. I want to be important, and I know I can make a contribution. And you're going to have to trust me on the fact that I'm here for a while. And usually people will buy that. Now, you may be lying. No, ma'am, just you may be. It's if it's not the right fit and you need something, take something until you get the right fit. But deliver. If somebody's going to give you an opportunity, deliver for them so that they don't regret that while you're there.
And what's your advice for people who get frustrated, feeling like the world is conspiring against them in this moment with their age and with changing technology so fast and with a pandemic on top of everything else?
You know, I've got notoriously bad feet. And when I go for these really long beach walks, sometimes 10, 11, 13 miles, and after about mile 7, my feet are killing me and I just want to stop. But I've noticed that if I take the next step, and then the next, and then the next, sooner or later, I get to where I need to go. And this kind of experience is exactly the same thing. It's that if every day you have 3 or 4 things you can do, no matter how tired you are of hitting the wall, you keep doing them every single day, sooner or later, you get where you need to go. It's all about taking the next step with certainty that sooner or later, you're going to break through and have your comeback.
Do you think that it's best to not take a break from your career if you can possibly avoid it? Don't quit to take care of the kids. Find some other way. You know, if you feel like you need to go travel the world, put that on hold until you retire. Like, it's just too risky to voluntarily and unnecessarily take a break in your career midway through.
Well, honestly, you're talking to somebody who is one of the major work-life balance speakers out there, and work life, not work like. And I'm always going to say, take the trip. I'm always going to say, live your life, because we're on this earth to grow as human beings, not as a job title. And so if you do make choices that have consequences in your professional life, you have to deal with them, but understanding that you got something else in return. And I talked to a guy, he went sailing forever. And then he came back and he was a tech guy and could not get hired at all. And then he went, got some new certifications, started making it really clear to his network what he was doing so he could get back in, and he got back in. You just have to take the steps that you have to take. Now, I know somebody who took a very long time out to raise her son. And it's like more than 15 years. Mm. And we were talking about, I said, well, are you good with tech? And she just goes, my son's a millennial. Like, that means you're good with technology because your kid's a millennial. And I'm sure if I said AI, she'd be like, oh, is that artificial intelligence? It's like, no, what does that have to do with your profession? What are they doing about it? Mm-hmm. If you're going to take a time out, you have to know there's going to be some homework you have to do to get back in. And you have to find ways to demonstrate that you are current. And if it's been a long time out, you may need to do some volunteer work, or this is always good, go with a temp job, because then you get exposure and current experience. So there's always something you can do. It may take a while. It may be costly in terms of your career, but what matters most when you leave this earth is that you did things to make your time here matter. And I always think of Brenda Barnes, who was my hero. She was the first of the big women CEOs, and she was president of PepsiCo North America. And so she gets to this power position. She's at the top of the Fortune Most Powerful Women in the World, and decides she's going to quit because she wants to take a time out and be with her kids. And that, of course, was international news. How dare you? You just showed women can't have it all. But she took 7 years, was with her kids. And then when they got, you know, late teens and weren't wanting to hang around with their mom, she went back to work as the CEO of Sara Lee Corporation. Now, you think Sara Lee is cheesecake, but it's a big holding company. And at the time, it was worth $40 billion and it was going down the tank because they had too many repetitious businesses. And she went to the board and said, we've got to dump 40% of these companies now. And they were behind her, but the stock plummeted. She was under extreme stress. And one night when she was bench pressing, she got up and passed out, had a brain bleed, and never was able to work another day in her life. Her kids, who she had taken that time out so she would know and be with, dropped everything and stayed in that room with her. And they were by her bedside the whole time. Her daughter had a big corporate job lined up after graduating college. And she said no and took the year off to take care of her mother. And sadly, Brenda died 4 years ago, but she did live a few years after the stroke. And what if she hadn't taken that time out? She never would have had healthy time with her kids. And what would her life have stood for? It would have just been work. So when you go through a setback, whether you've taken a deliberate timeout or you've got a forced timeout, make the time count, because every day is valuable, whether you're employed or unemployed. You matter. So make decisions that will propel you forward as a human being, not just as a professional.
Fawn Germer is a leadership speaker and author. Her book is Coming Back: How to Win the Job You Want When You've Lost the Job You Need. We spoke back in January. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. Once a week, the Top of Mind team dives into the archives to find conversations we'd like to hear again. Coming up in about 15 minutes, a lot of us let casual acquaintances wither during the pandemic. Should we try to bring those back? Just ahead, an effort to understand the mysterious ghost sharks of the sea. It's great to have you with us for Top of Mind Prime Cuts. It's our weekly director's cut of the show. I'm Julie Rose. There is a kind of shark that is so mysterious. It's called a ghost shark. It doesn't look at all like the great white with the menacing dorsal fin and big jaws from movies like, well, Jaws. Scientists think some species of ghost shark may be at risk of extinction, but they don't know for sure because they don't know much about ghost sharks in general. David Ebert is one of the world's leading experts on this mysterious type of creature. He's director of the Pacific Shark Research Center in Monterey, California. And I spoke with him earlier this year. It's a Top of Mind Prime Cut. Why are they called ghost sharks?
Well, other names they go by are things like chimeras, ratfish, or water bunnies. And if you use those terms, a lot of times people kind of like their eyes will kind of gloss over and they'll kind of think like, oh, okay. But if you mention ghost sharks, that just inspires people. They think like, wow, what's a ghost shark? And they get really excited about that. And so even though ghost shark is a term they use in many countries of the world, like Australia, New Zealand, you'll see that term quite common. I've tried to use it more frequently here in North America because it gets people more interested in these kind of curious little deep sea sharks that live in the ocean that most people don't even realize are a type of shark.
Okay. Well, I mean, what do they look like? Give us a sense of like your typical ghost shark.
Well, the term chimera actually comes from like a Greek mythology. It's kind of like and I think the early people kind of referred to them as chimeras because they look like a fish built by a committee. They have look like all kind. A lot of them have a big head. They'll have a fin spine behind them. They'll have kind of a narrow body. Some will be very plain colored. They have a large eye. They have a mouth that has almost like a parrot's beak inside of it. And so it literally looks like a fish built by committee. Hmm. They're actually one of the oldest shark lineages or fish lineages around, going back about 420 million years.
How big are we talking typically for a ghost shark?
A large one will get up to nearly 2 meters in length and nearly 6 feet, a large one.
Oh.
Most of them are around 3 or 4 feet in length.
Okay. And are they a lot like sharks that we would normally recognize, except that they just have some weird, you know, their fins are in weird spots and so forth?
No, no, that's the thing about it. A lot of people don't recognize them as sharks because most people, when they think of a shark, they'll think of like a white shark or a tiger shark or, you know, an oceanic white, something that people would have in their minds like a typical shark. But people don't realize there's like over 1,250 species of sharks in the world. And most of the sharks, you know, don't get very large. In fact, some of the sharks are so small you can hold in your palm of your hand. And when I talk about sharks, I'm also including the rays, because rays, what they really are is just, if you take a shark and you flatten it, that's what a ray is. It's basically a flat shark. Mm-hmm. And what unites like the ghost sharks, the rays or the flat sharks, and what you typically think of as sharks, is they all have a cartilaginous skeleton. Unlike, you know, you or me or most fishes, which have a bony skeleton, these all are united. I mean, they have a cartilaginous skeleton, and they all are united because if you can trace back their lineage in the geological record, you know, back hundreds of millions of years.
Hmm. And ghost sharks, what do they eat? Are they predators? Are they pretty vicious?
Well, they're not. You're not likely to get into trouble by the one biting you or anything. The chances are, if you actually see one, and there are a few that live in shallow water, you could encounter, they'll probably most likely just swim off, or they might kind of curiously swim up to check you out. Their mouths are very small, and they tend to eat like small invertebrates that live in the bottom, like sea stars, snails, shrimps, those types of things.
You've told us a fair amount about ghost sharks, but my understanding is that there's a lot we don't know about ghost sharks. So what mm-hmm. don't we know, even an expert like yourself?
I can tell you that we have over 25% of all known ghost sharks have only been really discovered in less than 20 years. We didn't even know they would have such a diverse group. And they're not really, there's right now, there's about 52 known species, and we're still discovering many new ones. And we don't really know what their role is in the environment out there. And that's the thing I try to stress to people, and that you think of a thing like a white shark. It's a large, you know, active predator. People understand that. But when you get to these smaller sharks, less known sharks like the ghost sharks, we don't really understand what their role is in the environment out there. And the concern is, like with these, a lot of these species that may be declining in numbers or become extirpated or may possibly go extinct, is we don't know what their role and how much they might impact or influence the environment. And by the time you, say, get up to a higher trophic level shark, like a white shark, it may be too late in terms of environmental damage that may be going on there. So that's why some of these things like these ghost sharks, which many of them are deep sea, are important to study.
Do we have reason to believe that their numbers are declining? Like, how would we even know that? Who's keeping track?
There's a few species we know, like in Europe and in the Western Pacific around the Philippines and Taiwan, in that area, that we think are in trouble. They're considered by the IUCN as to be vulnerable. There's also a couple species in South America, and those tend to be ones that are a little more shallow water that we have a better handle on. But most of them live in the deep sea, and so we don't really have a good idea of if they're being caught, how much they're being caught, and what's happening out there. And so that's, as I say, we've only really been discovering many of them in recent years. In fact, to give you an idea, my lab, we've discovered two species off the California coast here just in the last 10, 12 years. And here you think California, where I'm based here in Monterey, you know, kind of high-tech Silicon Valley, fairly well-educated society, and we're still discovering new species of sharks off the coast here. So when you move out globally and you look in some of these areas of the world, like in East Africa, parts of the Indian Ocean that are not as well studied, you think, wow, what's out there that we're missing?
Why has it only been in the last 20 years that you've been discovering and identifying more of these ghost sharks?
I think it's because there hasn't been many people outside myself and a handful of us that are actually bothered to even look for these things.
Are they hard to find?
Some are and some are not. Some of the species we've discovered, we've only known from a single specimen. Some we find in some areas that are fairly seem to be kind of common, but we just, nobody knew they were there. And so it's really, sometimes it's like going to look for these, you need to actually just take the time to go look for them.
How do you look for them if they're that far down?
Well, a lot of times I work in different sources. We'll look through, my big thing I do a lot of times, I'll go to fish markets in kind of far off places in the world, like in East Africa or someplace, or you go out on like a research vessels or commercial trawl vessels that are working in deep water to sometimes find these things. Other times you'll find them, like they'll show up like a research. They'll have these, they use a lot of these remote operated vehicles now, like ROVs. And you'll find some of these things through that way, by seeing videotapes of them that you didn't know they were even occurred there, but you seem to find them on the video. And that's because a lot of times in the deep sea, when you turn on the lights to take video footage, some of these deep sea fishes are actually attracted to the light.
Are ghost sharks fished intentionally for some purpose, for eating or something?
there are in a few areas of the world, in South America, parts of New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, and in Asia, that there are some species that are fished for eating.
Okay. But yeah. Is that the primary reason that they would be at risk, would because of overfishing?
In those areas, yes. In fact, some of the areas they've had to close a fishery in a couple areas because they were being overfished and then nobody was really managing them. It's one of these things that, you know, you think of things like tunas and stuff, which have, again, people well know, and they tend to be very well managed. But some of these other lesser known species, nobody pays attention to them. So you have these fisheries going on for them that no one's really aware of.
Hmm. Do they very often get caught up kind of accidentally in the nets when people are fishing for other stuff?
Yep. Correct. And that's another way they do. They sometimes take what's called bycatch or incidental catch, where they're taken. They'll be fishing for one thing and they'll catch these and these ghost sharks will be caught off like the West Coast here in North America. A lot of times they'll be just discarded, but in other parts of the world, they're actually retained and used and consumed. Hmm. You'll find just an example. Like I was in Sri Lanka a couple years ago, and they were catching one of these deep sea ghost sharks there. Nobody had any idea this was going on, but they would catch them, and they use the liver oil, the squalene, actually that goes into like a lot of cosmetic products. It goes in, it also goes into different food products as well. And here this thing was being fished, and nobody from the Sri Lankan government, any of the NGOs, no one had any idea this was going on. And so that's a common thing I'll come across oftentimes in my travels.
So your hope is that by doing a better job to identify and spread the word, that more research will be done, we'll start to learn more, and then we can really kind of get to a place where we can say, all right, here's what we need to do to protect the ghost sharks, and here's why.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what we need to do. I mean, some places, there's a couple species that occur in the Galapagos, for example, and the Galapagos is generally a well-protected area. It's like a big marine protected area. And so those species are probably less at risk. But there's other species that we find, like in the Southwest Indian Ocean, they occur in open waters outside anybody's economic exclusive zones. And so we have no idea what's going on in those areas, but we know they are being caught.
We've got about a minute and a half left.
Sure.
David Ebert, can you describe one of the ghost sharks that you have discovered personally, or your lab has discovered? What makes it special?
Yeah, well, it was one of the ones I've mentioned is the Eastern Pacific black ghost shark, which occurs off California from about Monterey Bay and south. And here's a species that we'd seen some images of and we were aware of for a while, but we just named this thing about 10 years ago. And again, we see with ROVs, we see these things are actually kind of common when you get down anywhere from 3,000 to 6,000 feet deep. And it was kind of exciting. I mean, there's nothing like, it's like Christmas every day when you go out trying to find these things. And when you discover them, it's like magic. It's just magic.
What does it look like? What makes this particular black shark special?
It's mostly black. It has a very kind of a dusky white snout when they're alive, and it's just very distinct from any. There's nothing else known from the Eastern Pacific like it, or even close to it. So it kind of stands out when you see it that while there's nothing here that we didn't even know about this thing.
Can you kind of draw the picture for us? Like if I was looking at it, how big is it? What kind of shape is it?
It gets about 4 feet. It has a very large head, and tapers back to a very narrow body, especially as you go back towards the tail. It has a very large eye, and they tend to be very shy.
Just one eye? It only has one eye?
No, it has two eyes.
Okay.
I'm sorry, two eyes on each side. Yeah, it has two very large eyes on each side. It has a very narrow mouth. And as they say, the teeth are almost like a beak in a way. And so kind of pecks away at things that it eats. And as I say, if you just imagine this thing with a large head going back to a very thin tail on the body, it has very large, what are called pectoral fins, which would be sort of analogous like your arms, very large. And it tends to hover when you see it like in a video, for example.
Oh. So it kind of flutters its pectoral fins like wings, kind of?
It hovers almost. Yeah, it literally, when you see it, And there are just to let people know, there are videotapes of this. You can go online, Google Eastern Pacific black ghost shark, Hydrolagus melanophasma, and you can see it. They look like they're hovering.
That's David Ebert. He's one of the world's leading experts on ghost sharks and director of the Pacific Shark Research Center. I spoke with him in January of this year. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. Coming up, many of our casual acquaintances got left behind during the pandemic. Is it worth the trouble to revive them? I'm Julie Rose. Thanks so much for tuning in today to Top of Mind Prime Cuts. Something that has really changed for a lot of us during the pandemic is casual relationships. Saying hi to a coworker from a different department when you pass in the hallway, or having a quick chat with a neighbor after church. Instead, we have doubled down on deeper relationships with close friends and family members. Have we lost anything in the process? Psychologist Jillian Sandstrom studies the value of weaker relationships, and she spoke with Top of Mind's Ciara Hewlett back in April. Sandstrom is a professor at the University of Essex in England. Let's listen.
Can you give an example of one of these casual relationships that's benefited you?
Oh, I've had so many over the years. I mean, I guess there are things like, you know, the people who work at the gym. And so every time I go to the gym, it's, you know, someone that I recognize and a friendly face. And it just, I think, even helps me keep going back to the gym because, you know, someone there knows who I am. I can think of Barry at the pet food store, and every time I'd go in to buy food for my cats, he'd ask about how my cats were doing. So those kind of things.
And so weak ties are just those casual interactions, people that you aren't super close with, but you have some relationship with.
Yeah. I mean, I think so. I mean, you could use the word acquaintance. It's broader. I guess my research has focused on the people who are sort of the most minimal connections we have in our social network. So I guess when I think of the word weak tie, I tend to mean, you know, those people that we would never, maybe people we would never even have a, you know, go out for a drink with or anything, but we just chat with it when we see them. And, you know, so they're kind of the sort of most minimal relationships that we have.
And why are those relationships important?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good question, because I think a lot of people sort of assume that they're not. And I hope that maybe one silver lining of the pandemic is that it does make people realize that all these people that we have in our lives do make a difference, and kind of for, we have this sort of tapestry of relationships, and it's not just the close ones that matter. So my research shows that our interactions with weak ties, the more we have, the happier we are, essentially. They put us in a good mood. They help us feel connected to other people. I've done some research during COVID that shows that people having a chat with someone they never even met before just helps us feel more trusting in general of other people. So it just really sort of connects us to something bigger, I think. Not to mention the fact that they're also just often fun and provide new information. We kind of hear the same things over and over when we talk to the people that we're close to. We know their opinions on things. We know what kind of experiences they've had. So we learn new information and broaden our perspective more when we talk to those people that are further out in our social networks.
Is that why those interactions make us happier then? Because of the novelty and perhaps that they're giving us information outside of, like you said, our normal circle?
Yeah, I mean, I'm happier. Yeah, sorry. The way you said happier, it made it sound like happier than the people we're close to. I'm not trying to say that at all. Obviously, the people we're close to matter a lot. But I think we're underestimating how happy that these kind of weak tie interactions can make us feel. And yeah, I think that's part of it, is that they are new and different and also spontaneous. And to the extent that people enjoy things that are sort of unexpected, you know, often these conversations come about just because we happen to walk past someone and we see them and we're like, oh, how cool, I haven't seen you for so long. And so there's that spontaneity. It wasn't planned. It was just by accident. There's something pleasant about that too, I think.
Is it also possibly because we're on our best behavior? And so those interactions might be a little bit more positive in general.
Yeah, and I think we're not going to talk about the really contentious things with someone we've just met either. You know, we're not going to talk about those big topics that we avoid over Thanksgiving dinner. So yeah, I think we're on our best behavior. We're trying to show our best selves, and yeah, that can make the conversation go a bit more smoothly.
Yeah, and I generally, like you were saying at the Thanksgiving dinner or whatever, that I might share with deep people I'm really close to, I might tell them about, oh, you know, I just had this really disappointing thing happen to me, and, you know, and I tell them about that, and that might make me sad or that kind of thing. Whereas with people that I'm not close to, you know, I might not ever share that, and maybe that it's less pressure. Maybe it's just more positive in general overall, because I might not share things that are sad about my life with someone.
That's true. But actually, you know, there is that kind of trope about people sharing all their heartaches with the bartender, with the hairdresser. So I think there's some research showing that sometimes people prefer to disclose things to people they're less close to, which seems surprising. But it's a little less risky to do that. So if you're worried about how someone's going to take it, it's a lot less risky to disclose to someone you're less close to. And then if it goes horribly wrong, you know, you've lost that relationship. It's not as awful and life-changing as if you lost a relationship with someone you're really close to.
Oh.
And also when you disclose something to someone you're close to, people worry that, oh, well, next time I see them, I'm going to think about how I told them that really private thing. And what if they bring it up again? And so it's a little less complicated actually to disclose to someone that you're less close to.
Yeah. Or there's that, you have to give them the update on whatever it was, and maybe you don't want to talk about it anymore. And then,
right.
Yeah. do these interactions also give us more opportunity in some way that we can learn about things outside of what we would normally know? I don't know. Maybe it could give us an opportunity for a new job or something that we would never hear of. And that's why these relationships are also important.
Yeah, well, the term weak tie was actually coined by a sociologist, Mark Granovetter, back in the 70s. And he did a little study back then and found that people were more likely to find a new job through a weak tie rather than a strong tie. And again, it seems a little surprising because, you know, you think that your strong ties would be the ones who are most motivated to help you. But it's, you know, you don't have that many strong ties. And so the amount of information that they have access to is limited. And so weak ties just kind of widen your circle and can open you up to different opportunities. And then there's a more recent study looking at creativity, which I find really interesting. And so this was done at the workplace, and people who had more weak ties at work were judged by their supervisors to be more creative. And so if you think about it, it's probably just that they can connect ideas from different parts of the company. They just have access to more kinds of information, and creativity is all about putting different kinds of ideas together.
And you would also get more new perspectives and possibly think differently when you're interacting with all these other people that aren't super close to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm speaking with Jillian Sandstrom. She's a professor of psychology at the University of Essex. What does it require, though, to get that happiness boost from these interactions? How many do you need to be having a day?
Oh, gosh, I don't know if there's a particular number, but what I can tell you is from the research that I've done is that on days when people have more weak tie interactions than they usually do, they tend to be a little bit happier than they usually are. So it's maybe not a specific number. I mean, different people have different preferences. So not everybody is going to want or value the same number of interactions.
Right now in the pandemic, how do we, before things go back to normal, how can we bring back these weak tie relationships?
Well, I think some of them are really hard because to the extent that we have them because of the activities we're doing, if we haven't yet returned to those activities, it's pretty hard to bring those weak ties back. And I think those in particular are probably more likely to be the kind where we may not even know how to contact them. You know, like the person in the yoga class maybe isn't someone that you've ever exchanged phone numbers with even. So those ones are really hard, but I think we don't really need to worry about them because they'll come back when the activities come back. I've done all this research on weak ties, but I've also done a lot of research on strangers. It's sort of my research migrated one step further out in the social network. And I guess that's where I've been focusing my attention during the pandemic, is the weak ties are not there. And it doesn't feel like there's much I can do about that right now. But instead, I've been, you know, keeping those social skills honed by talking to strangers. And there's fewer opportunities for that too, but there's still opportunities. You know, I still go to the grocery store and talk to the checkout person, have I'm sure all of us have packages of one sort or another delivered to the door. So I'm always talking to the people who bring the packages. And I have actually, I have groceries delivered, and I have a favorite grocery delivery person who also always talks about my cats. And then I go for walks in the park every day, and I'm always talking to dog walkers or other people going for a walk. And it makes me feel good. And on days when I'm feeling anxious or upset, which, you know, we're all having those days, and I think we've all been a little bit more open about admitting it lately with the pandemic, just having, you know, making eye contact with someone and sharing a smile can just really make me feel better. And so I like to think that maybe I'm that person for someone else. And so I go out of my way to smile and wave and say hi to people when I walk past them.
So part of it then is just looking for those opportunities to create a weak tie or talk to a stranger, because talking to strangers, as your research shows, is also beneficial and makes us happier. And so just kind of searching for those opportunities. And
I think there's more opportunities than you think. And I think converting a stranger into a weak tie, I mean, I guess one thing to think about is having a regular pattern, you know, so the fact that I order groceries at a similar time means I get the same delivery driver. And so that then I can turn that into a weak tie rather than having a different person come every time. So, you know, if you're, and that's how you get a favorite barista at the coffee shop, right? Like you go when their shift is happening. So to the extent that you have a pattern that you can build up, that's going to make it easier to develop those kind of relationships.
Should we also reach out to some of our casual relationships that we do have their number that we haven't talked to in a long time and just say hi, check in?
I mean, sure, why not? I mean, ask yourself the question, what would you think if one of them sent you a text message and just said, hi, I'm thinking about you? I mean, it feels good, doesn't it? So if you're so inclined, and it doesn't have to be a big, you know, a big thing, doesn't have to be a phone call where, you know, you feel like you have to talk to them for half an hour or something. You can just send a quick message and tell them you're thinking of them. And I think most people would appreciate that.
And that's a key here, that it's low pressure, right? That it's not a long conversation or anything, because that's how those interactions always are. And if it starts to be like, we need to talk about our lives and everything that's happening, then it might turn into more of a burden and feel more like a deeper relationship.
Yeah, and we don't want to feel burdens right now.
Yeah.
We don't need extra stress right now.
Yeah, we're all a little emotionally exhausted, but your argument is that even if we do try to reach out and do these things, that it won't feel like a burden, that it won't be too exhausting to talk to these weak
ties. No, and I think it's one of those things where you know, it might be something where you feel like, oh, you know, I'm not in a good mood. I don't want to go out and smile at people and say hi. Like, I'm just not feeling like it. But actually, if you do it, you'll feel better for having done it. And so that's something you kind of learn by sort of forcing yourself to do it in those days when maybe you don't feel like it. And we know, you know, the research on depression, that's what happens, is people get stuck in this negative cycle because they're feeling depressed, and then they don't want to reach out, and then they haven't reached out, and so they get more depressed, and it's this negative cycle. And so we tend to not reach out when we need it the most. So it's one of those, you know, beautiful things about humans, I think, is that if you want to feel better, you need to reach out to others, you need to help others and try to do something kind for other people, and that will actually make you feel better too.
And then once pandemic's over, we'll need to try and not be socially awkward and talk to the people, and we pass them in the hall or things like that, right?
Yeah, and I think we'll have to be kind to ourselves, because, you know, there's lots of people who are shy or anxious, or, you know, and having not talked to many people for the last year. Well, first of all, it's, you know, it's now has this sort of feeling like people are kind of dangerous and scary, you know, that's sort of the message we've been getting for the last year. And so it's going to be hard to turn that off, I think. I mean, I know in the first couple months of the pandemic, I'd go for a walk in the park across the street, and I didn't even want to look at people because, you know, it felt dangerous. And then it took me a bit to sort of get over that and remind myself, you know, I can't get infected from looking at someone. And, you know, we're all anxious. And so it can mean even more right now if we can smile and connect with one another and acknowledge our shared humanity. But yeah, it might take some practice. I mean, they don't call it social skills for nothing. So there are skills involved, and we do need practice to build up our confidence and feel more positive about it. I've been trying very much lately when I talk to people to talk to reporters and journalists to point out that I'm very much an introvert. So I don't want people listening to this to think, you know, you have to be an extrovert to do something like this. But it is something that I've worked up to. So I'm very much a proponent, and my research supports the idea that practice really does make perfect. And so if you're really anxious about it, don't feel like you have to talk to people right away. Start by making eye contact. That's hard enough if you're anxious to just make eye contact with people. And there's research showing that just making eye contact with someone helps them feel better. I did have this day a couple months ago where I was just so upset and, you know, just wasn't even looking at people. And this lady smiled at me, and it was enough to just create a little space in that, you know, to stop that negative voice in the head for a second. And it made a huge difference to me. So it was just a reminder of how much it can mean to do this. So make eye contact, then smile at people, and maybe just try to start noticing the opportunities that you have to talk to people. And then eventually, when you feel comfortable, start to have a little chat.
That's Jillian Sandstrom, a professor of psychology at the University of Essex in England. Top of Mind Ciara Hewlett spoke with her back in the spring. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. We are a production of BYU Radio. I'm Julie Rose. One of the things that Top of Mind listeners tell us they like about the show is the wide variety of topics we discuss. Just in the last month or so, we've talked about the neurons in your brain that trigger negative feelings when you're hungry. They're the hangry neurons. We heard how they worked. And we met a woman who always had a knack for whistling. Now she's a sought-after performer on the indie music scene. Her whistling is so ethereal and beautiful. You will be really surprised when you realize she's whistling. Find those stories on our podcast feed. Look for Top of Mind wherever you get your podcasts. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. I'm Julie Rose. Every week, the Top of Mind team combs through our archives to select conversations that deserve another listen. This hour, as we mark the 20th anniversary of 9/11, we'll take a close look at the wars it sparked. Retired Army Colonel Andrew Bacevich says America's war on terror was misguided from the start. Also, one reason lots of workers are opting to quit rather than return to the office is toxic workplace culture. We'll find out what it is and how to deal with it. All of that coming up on Top of Mind Prime Cuts. After 20 years of fighting in Afghanistan, it's a bitter pill for the U.S. to see the Taliban back in control of the country. But American veterans who fought in that war are far more likely than the general American public to say leaving now was the right move. A recent poll of Afghanistan war veterans, done by Morning Consult, shows veterans are conflicted about the war. They say it was necessary, but also intrusive and wasteful. Retired Army Colonel Andrew Bacevich is more pointed in his critique. He says if America had learned the lessons of Vietnam, we would not have invaded Afghanistan or Iraq. Bacevich fought in Vietnam. His son died in the Iraq War. His new book is a rebuke of American political leaders, Republican and Democrat, who continue to believe in the power of America's military to solve the world's problems. The book is called After the Apocalypse. Bacevich is an emeritus professor of international relations and history at Boston University, currently president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. I spoke with him a couple of months ago, just as U.S. troops began leaving Afghanistan and as the Taliban was rapidly retaking control. What lesson from the Vietnam War would suggest that invading Afghanistan and Iraq after the 9/11 terror attacks, that in neither case was that going to go well?
Well, there's all kinds of lessons. I think the most prominent one, though, was the importance of taking into account the history and the culture of the people that we set out to redeem or to save. That's what we did, attempted to do in Vietnam. We imagined, and this, of course, was in the context of the Cold War. We imagined that we could convert the Republic of Vietnam, a rather recently created quasi-nation, we could convert that into a functioning liberal democracy with effective security forces. That was a fool's errand. After 9/11, we sought to do something of the same thing in Afghanistan and in Iraq. Again, in both cases, fool's errand, because we didn't understand the history and the culture of those countries.
But after Al-Qaeda attacked the World Trade Center and the Pentagon in 2001, America had been attacked on its own soil. Thousands of people had died. It was a national trauma. We had to respond, didn't we? I mean, there had to be some kind of military action. We couldn't just sit by.
Absolutely. And the response needed to be directed at the perpetrators of the attack. That is to say, this terrorist organization called Al-Qaeda. And I think have long believed that the appropriate response would have been for the United States to treat terrorism, treat Al-Qaeda as an international criminal conspiracy, and to rally the nations of the world who have a common interest in opposing terrorism, to rally them together in a campaign to eliminate Al-Qaeda. What we chose instead, what the George W. Bush administration chose instead, was to declare a global war on terrorism and then to set out to campaign against what President Bush called an axis of evil. The axis of evil consisted of Iran, Iraq, and North Korea, none of which had anything to do with 9/11. So that set us on the wrong path, I think.
So if we had instead taken the option that you described as more appropriate, declaring, going after terrorists as a global threat, but not a military, like it wouldn't have been the military that would have responded. What would we have done instead if we had rallied our allies against terrorism as a criminal enterprise?
I think we would have put together an international, collaborative police effort. Police effort to root out the criminals. Now, when I say police, I don't necessarily mean the cop on the corner wearing a blue uniform. I'm talking about probably intelligence agencies, special operations forces, but directed at rooting out the conspiracy, not directed at invading and occupying countries, which is what the global war on terrorism quickly transitioned to.
What was such a fool's errand, though, about the idea that Saddam Hussein, okay, so he doesn't have weapons of mass destruction, but he's still not a great guy. A lot of people are living under oppression in Iraq. He's causing trouble for us in the region. Let's get rid of him and bring a different kind of stability and democracy to Iraq. Why was that a fool's errand to begin with?
Well, the way you pose the question, get rid of him, and then somehow magically, the democratic and stable Iraq emerges in its place. You know, why would one think that transition would occur that easily? And of course, we know it didn't occur. We did overthrow Saddam Hussein fairly easily in terms of the exertions required. But when we did that, we basically touched off a civil war within Iraq. The disorder, the chaos, the anarchy in Iraq created a vacuum filled by terrorist organizations, not only Al-Qaeda, but also perhaps more dangerously, ISIS. So the notion that because we have great military power, we have the capacity to bring about political transformations in distant countries that we don't particularly understand, I think that notion is a dangerous one. Mm. I'm not a pacifist. I'm not an isolationist. I'm not anti-military, but I have to admit, have to say that as I have become older, I have come to believe that the utility of military power is actually fairly limited. And what's it good for? Mm. Well, it's good to defend. It's good for defending. It's good for deterring. It's good for containing. But it's not necessarily good for embarking upon grand offensives with expectations of bringing about positive political change. Now, I'm sure that somebody smarter than me could point to this instance or that instance where transformation as a consequence of invasion occurred fairly quickly. But that sure the heck didn't occur in Iraq and Afghanistan post 9/11. And I think the consequences for our country have been terrible, negative, have weakened us, have divided us. And quite frankly, the consequences for Afghans and Iraqis have probably been even worse than the consequences for Americans.
So at the time that your son enlisted then and deployed to Iraq in 2007, did you already hold these views?
Yeah, I'm not going to talk a lot about my son, if you don't mind. But there is an assumption on the part of some people, I'm not saying this is your assumption, that the views that I express in writing somehow derive from the fact that my son was killed in Iraq. Mm. There's a chronology problem here. If one looks at what I have been writing for the last 20 plus years, it will become pretty clear that my critique of U.S. military policy predated the time when my son entered the Army.
You have written recently, though, about grappling with the question of who's to blame for your son's death.
Yeah, it's because my wife and I got a more than annoying letter from a Washington-based law firm saying that inviting us to join in a lawsuit aimed at suing the government of Iran and getting the government of Iran to compensate us for our son's death, I found that beyond insulting and presumptuous. And I have to admit that in a bout of anger, I decided to write something to denounce that entire undertaking by this law firm.
And your conclusion, though, is that you blame all of us to some extent for buying into what? Into what idea, which fundamental idea that you're concerned about here.
We're a democracy. We're a democracy. We're an imperfect democracy. And however imperfectly, I believe that the actions of our government do express the will of the people. And although there was a brief and actually rather impressive bit of anti-war demonstrating on the eve of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, it was very brief. And basically, we the people went along with the architecture of the global war on terrorism that George W. Bush embarked upon. And as the wars stretched out year after year, I say wars because it was not just Iraq, it was also Afghanistan, it was other places. We kept paying our taxes, and as long as the all-volunteer force provided the human capital to go wage these wars. To put it bluntly, we the people didn't much care about how those wars were going. If we had cared, then we would have nominated and elected people other than those we did. Now, one might say parenthetically that in 2016, we did elect an anti-war candidate. Donald Trump, in my judgment, far and away the worst president we've ever had in our entire history, nonetheless, campaigned explicitly expressing his opposition to endless wars, forever wars, whatever we want to call them, and he won. I don't believe that he won simply because he was opposed to endless wars. I think he won in part because he was opposed to endless wars, whereas his opponent back in 2016, Hillary Clinton, was a perpetrator of endless wars. As a senator, she'd voted for the invasion of Iraq in 2003. As a Secretary of State, she was an architect for the catastrophic intervention in Libya that overthrew a dictator, Colonel Gaddafi, but then led to Libya descending into anarchy. So at least Trump was saying things that opponents of our military policies could identify with, although to emphasize, Trump had no serious interest in governance. He was lazy, and therefore his rhetoric never really translated into action.
Andrew Bacevich, would you explain for us a bit of the history of that you lay out in the book of why it is that American leaders of all political stripes and American voters largely as well are so invested in this idea of America's military is the best military and it can do anything?
Well, let me expand on the question. It's a good question, but let me expand on it just a little bit. The real question is not simply why are we invested in an idea of military supremacy as providing a useful instrument, but also why are we invested in the idea of American primacy? Why do we believe in this thing that I call, that others call, American exceptionalism? What's that? American exceptionalism is the claim that we are the chosen people, that history or providence has endowed the United States with a unique and special role. And that role is to bring history to its intended conclusion. Now, just the way I said that posits that history has a logic, that history has a narrative leading somewhere. I don't think those are true. But the idea of American exceptionalism takes that as true. So we believe, going back to the founding of our republic, we believe that we are called upon to bring history to its intended conclusion. And the events of our time, let's say dating from World War II, but certainly including the end of the Cold War, the conclusion of the Cold War, we read those events as affirmations of that calling, of that summons. We see those events as affirming, for providing concrete evidence that American exceptionalism is true. Mm. Now, when the Cold War ended, there was an additional component, in a sense that got added to American exceptionalism. And the additional component was a belief in American military supremacy. We had mastered war. Why would we think that? Well, we thought that because some people in Washington believed that the Soviets gave up, they abandoned the Cold War, because the Soviets had reached the conclusion that the United States had a military edge over the USSR that could never be never could be met. And right after the end of the Cold War, we had Operation Desert Storm, the first war against Saddam Hussein. In retrospect, really a war of little consequence, but at the time perceived to be an unprecedented military victory. So, but roughly between 1989 and 1991, this belief in American military supremacy came to grip the nation, and especially grip American elites, the people responsible for foreign policy. And I think that it's a combination of American exceptionalism and a belief in American military supremacy that really was the poison that did great harm to us. Again, and referring to, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and I was just going to point out, it was 20 years ago. I think some of us may have forgotten the details, but it was pretty sobering to read some of the quotes from, you know, members of the George W. Bush administration at the time, you know, arguing for the invasion of Iraq and talking about how this was going to be a quick thing and, you know, we're going to be in and out and nobody can stand against us. Same thing in Afghanistan. It's a quick incursion. This will be over soon. And so do you think that was just like complete naivete? Was there a possibility that it could have been quick and we just didn't throw enough guns and troops at it in either of those cases?
Well, to be fair, in both the case of Iraq and Afghanistan, it was quick and then it wasn't quick. Mm. In other words, the proponents of invasion, the proponents of go in, hit them hard, and get this war taken care of, proved to be right. If we simply limit our examination to the entry of U.S. forces into Afghanistan in 2001 and into Iraq in 2003, in a matter of weeks, we overthrew the Taliban regime. In a matter of weeks, we overthrew the Saddam Hussein regime. Problem was, the wars didn't end. Indeed, the wars were just beginning. And the wars became a different kind of war, people's war, insurgencies, irregular war, unconventional war, and the sort of, go in fast and hit them hard methodology no longer applied. And so in both cases, we found ourselves in protracted wars that turned out to be exceedingly costly. And we never figured out a recipe to pacify either country. There was a moment in 2007, 2008, when it appeared that the so-called surge in Iraq had provided a recipe for restabilizing that country. That proved to be an illusion, however. And so, here we are in 2021, and the fact of the matter is that the ultimate effect of both of those conflicts was to create instability, not stability, and actually to promote terrorism rather than to eliminate it. And I think that's a reality that, quite frankly, the foreign policy establishment and senior U.S. military leaders have not yet been willing to reckon with.
And the core argument of your book, Andrew Bacevich, is that our unwillingness to reckon with that is distracting us from the real threats that we have experienced, perhaps just a taste of, in the last year with the COVID pandemic, with some of the climate disasters tied to climate change, and also with the uprising related to race and racism in America.
Yeah. So when I grew up, from the time I grew up, the prevailing conception of national security presumed that the primary threats to our security and well-being, America's security and well-being, the primary threats were out there, far away, and that needed to be the priority in terms of national security resources. We needed to worry about the security of Europe, of Japan, of the Korean Peninsula, of the Persian Gulf. That's where U.S. forces needed to be prepared to fight and where, in many cases, they did fight. And if we could handle that, then we, the people here at home, were going to be okay. What my book argues is what becomes, blazingly apparent in 2020 is that the proximate threats to our security and well-being are here where Americans live. And you ticked off several of them. I mean, the natural disasters that are being exacerbated by climate change, the pandemic. I mean, this was not the first pandemic. It probably won't be the last. The economic crisis that resulted from the pandemic, with millions thrown out of work, millions of businesses destroyed. And as you suggested, not unrelated, I think, is this demand for a reckoning with American racism, which has prompted a white backlash. If we want to secure American freedom, if we want to prolong the American way of life, which I think would require modifying the American way of life, then the nexus of security policy needs to be here where we live, not out there in East Asia or Europe. And that would require a massive change in the mindset of the foreign policy establishment. Mm.
That's retired Army Colonel Andrew Bacevich. He's an emeritus professor at Boston University, president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. And his new book is called After the Apocalypse, America's Role in a World Transformed. We have to take a very quick break here on Top of Mind Prime Cuts. When we come back, we'll hear what that massive change is that he's talking about. I'm Julie Rose. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. I'm Julie Rose. It's good to have you along for this weekly deep dive into the archive of Top of Mind for conversations we'd like to hear again. We are marking the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 terror attacks with a look at the wars that those attacks sparked. Retired Army Colonel and Vietnam veteran Andrew Bacevich says America's entire approach to the war on terror was misguided. And he fears even with the failure in Afghanistan, U.S. leaders have not fully learned the correct lesson. Bacevich is president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. His most recent book about about America's military involvement in the world is called After the Apocalypse. I spoke with Bacevich back in July. This was just as U.S. troops began leaving Afghanistan. Here is the rest of our conversation. So, Mr. Bacevich, if the greatest threats to American security today are right here in America, and if there's something like a virus that can cause a pandemic that brings our economy to a halt, what does that have to do with also wanting to have a really strong military, right? Like, I mean, I think the conversation we've been hearing a lot of is, well, of course we need to have the strongest, best, and most amazing military in the world. Oh, and also, yes, there are these other threats, so we got to figure out a way to deal with those too. Do you see this as a yes and or more of an either or? We need to make some choices about priorities here.
No, it's a matter of choices. We need to have a military that is sized, organized, positioned so that it satisfies the basic interests of the country. To begin with the assumption, I don't mean this is your assumption, but I do think it's an assumption of many, to begin with the assumption that by golly, we have to have far and away the most powerful military in the world stationed all over the world. I accept that that has long been a basis of U.S. policy, but I think it's time to revisit it. Now, what might that look like in practice? And let me give you what I'm sure some of the listeners would consider an oversimplified explanation, but I think it's at least illustrative. Let's break the world into three big chunks. One chunk is Europe, one chunk is East Asia, one chunk is the Middle East. We've been committed to the security of Europe ever since the end of World War II. NATO was created in 1949 to guarantee the security of Western Europe in the face of what then seemed like a dangerous threat in the form of Stalin's Soviet Union. I think that the creation of NATO was a brilliant and enlightened act of statesmanship. And it was because of the conditions that existed in 1949. What were those conditions? Well, Western Europe was flat on its back, devastated by World War II. I think psychologically devastated by not simply World War II, but World War I, which had happened only a couple decades earlier. Western Europe needed help. We offered it. It was the right thing to do. Well, in 2021, the Europe of 1949 is long gone. Europe today is prosperous. Europe today is stable. It's democratic. Yes, it has certain problems, for example, related to immigration or to related to authoritarian tendencies in places like Poland and Hungary. But basically, we have accomplished our mission of enabling Europe to recover from World War II. And by extension, I would argue, therefore, it's time for the Europeans to assume responsibility for their own security, which means that the United States should withdraw from NATO. Mm. Let NATO become owned and operated by the Europeans. We don't need to withdraw tomorrow. We could withdraw. We could have it occur over the course of a decade. But Europe is capable of fulfilling, of taking care of its own security. Let's go on to the Middle East. Under the terms of the Carter Doctrine, your listeners maybe won't remember that, as a 1980 declaration by Jimmy Carter designating the Persian Gulf as a vital U.S. national security interest, a place we would fight for. Under the current terms of the Carter Doctrine, we have been fighting in the Middle East almost continuously ever since. Not a lot of victories to chalk up, a lot of sacrifices made by U.S. forces. And oh, by the way, the assumption that prevailed in 1980 that our prosperity, our way of life was dependent upon access to Persian Gulf oil and no longer pertains. So my argument about the Middle East is that U.S. military efforts have failed and therefore the U.S. military presence should be withdrawn. And we should rely on other means, diplomacy, to try to secure our interests in the region, which are real, but not necessarily vital. Third region, East Asia. We've also been in East Asia since the end of World War II, guaranteeing the security of Japan more since the 1950s, the security of South Korea. I would argue that our presence in that region has contributed to stability, or to flip the coin, given the effects of the rise of China, which makes everybody nervous in that region, were we to withdraw from East Asia, I think the result would be an arms race involving Japan, involving South Korea, probably involving everybody to include Australia and Vietnam and so on. And therefore, what makes sense is for us to maintain our security commitment to that part of the world. Now, if you look at all that together, yeah, probably that creates a Department of Defense, which is smaller than it is now, a Pentagon budget, which is probably smaller than it is now, and freeing up resources then for other institutions that make a more immediate contribution to our security and well-being, dealing with climate, dealing with disease, dealing with borders, and so on.
And what do we do about Russia?
Well, fair question. First of all, we have to begin with a realistic evaluation of what the Russian threat is. Russia is not the Soviet Union. It's substantially smaller. Putin is a bad egg. He's not Joseph Stalin. Putin does not aspire to spread some kind of ideology. He is a nationalist. He certainly intends to try to restore some semblance of Russian greatness. If I'm not mistaken, the Russian GDP is about equivalent to that of Italy. And so from my point of view, the Russian threat is A, real, and B, limited. And to go back to my evaluation of European capabilities, I would argue that Europe is fully capable of dealing with it, protecting itself from a Russian threat, if it chose to do so. You know, Germany's got far and away the biggest economy in Europe these days. I think Germany invests something on the order of 1.2 or 1.3% of its GDP on its military. NATO requirement is for a minimum of 2%. Germany blows that off. And frankly, we let them get away with it because of our insistence that we have an obligation to provide for the security of Europe. Mm. So if the Europeans would step up to the plate, then I think that the Russian threat, again, I'm not denying that there is a Russian threat, but I think that the Russian threat could easily be handled.
So President Trump's administration got a lot of criticism for talking about leaving NATO, which you've already said you think would be a good idea. But more broadly, for having a foreign policy approach that was perceived by a lot of our allies around the world as kind of like, well, I'm concerned most about America's needs and what's in it for us, you know, in approaching a lot of these different alliances. But it sounds to me like you think that that is the kind of reorientation that we need, that each of our, anytime we're involved, we don't have to close ourselves and turn away from the rest of the world. But anytime we're going to spend money or military or send our military, there needs to be a clear justification for why this is of value to an American living in the middle of America somewhere. Am I getting that right?
Oh, absolutely. And why do I believe that? I believe that because when we send U.S. forces to fight in some faraway place, the result is going to be that American troops are going to be killed, wounded, have their lives disrupted, come home bearing all kinds of psychological or emotional scars of war. And therefore, it ought to be some pretty darned important reason for sending them in harm's way. You know, in a way where I think we're touching on here indirectly, we're touching on the whole question of the all-volunteer force. At the end of until the Vietnam War, the tradition of the citizen soldier was central to our military system. When the United States faced a big problem in terms of security, we turned to the citizen soldier to deal with that problem, not to the professional military. That pertained until Vietnam. The controversies, understandable controversies, triggered by Vietnam, led the United States to abandon the tradition of a citizen soldier in
including a draft or some sort of mandatory service. Is that what the citizen soldier idea?
I mean, the tradition didn't necessarily rely on a draft. Mm. You know, it was a citizen soldier who fought and won the Civil War. And by and large, the Union forces consisted of volunteers. It was only in the 20th century that with World War I, that the tradition came to include conscription. And yes, conscription certainly became controversial. But my real point is, after Vietnam, we opted for what the founders would have called a standing army. And one of the unintended consequences of that was to create a division between the American people and their military. So that yes, there's all this support the troops kind of rhetoric. But in my judgment, there is not a serious engagement on the part of the American people with what we have our forces doing and where they're doing it and with what expectations of success. And quite frankly, I would point to the Iraq and Afghanistan wars as evidence to reinforce my point. Both those wars have ended in failure. Well, where is the discussion of what went wrong? Where's the accountability? You know, there is none. And I think that one of the reasons there's no accountability is because the American people are not genuinely invested in the well-being of the American military. Mm.
But we're able to feel okay about that because we salute the troops before NFL games.
And
pull out the flags on Memorial Day.
Exactly.
So in some ways, it's masking our lack of like true engagement in the choices and the losses that we've experienced.
Masking is a good term.
So, you're not anti-military. America needs a military. You're not saying that America should just close its doors and ignore the rest of the world. But if the priorities need to change, how would you tick off for them? Like, what would your message be to President Biden's administration and this, you know, the Defense Secretary and the Secretary of State about, you know, where that you've talked about where we should pull back from our military presence? How do we deal with something like racism in America. I mean, it's not like we're not dealing with it, but it's not the kind of thing you can just like create a budget line item and build a bigger plane and that's going to fix the problem. So, you know, what do we do? How do we approach these maybe more difficult to get our arms around threats regarding climate change and disease spread and racial division?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, if I could answer your very good question, you know, I'd be famous. But I guess I would say this, you know, there is in Washington right now a demand for an accounting of the July 6th assault on the Capitol. You know, the idea that the Congress, since we can't get an impartial commission, at least the Congress can undertake an investigation to provide some concrete answers. Why did this happen? You know, who should be called to account? I absolutely favor that. I don't know that the Republicans are going to let it happen, but I favor that idea. But I would contrast that with where is the effort to provide accountability for the failed wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? I think we need a commission to investigate that. We need a commission to help us understand why those wars occurred, because they were, in particular the Iraq war, a war of choice, why it occurred, why the wars unfolded as they did, why the wars produced the conclusions that they produced, and what are the lessons that we learned from that. In other words, we can't simply move on from Iraq and Afghanistan, and now we're just going to have a conversation about the need to confront the People's Republic of China. I think that is utterly irresponsible. But there doesn't seem to be much of an appetite for that kind of accounting, as far as I can tell.
But why? Why wouldn't there be an appetite if you're the Biden administration and, you know, you're dealing with the consequences of these misguided wars? I mean, why wouldn't there?
Remember that Biden voted for the Iraq war.
Yeah.
His fingerprints are on it. I mean, the both parties have their fingerprints on it. And we're talking about failure. It's a failure that to which the military itself contributed. I'm not suggesting that like there's some kind of little simple answer here, but by God, the most powerful military in the world failed to accomplish its mission in Iraq, failed in Afghanistan, and the failure is to some degree a military failure. The generals we put in charge didn't get it done. So I just think that accountability with regard to our recent military disappointments might provide a point of departure for rethinking overall U.S. national security strategy.
Because it would be a big sales job, though, to convince Congress to cut military spending dramatically or to close down,
big sales job. Big sales job doesn't come close to the challenge. You're exactly right, because what you're really talking about here is the military-industrial complex. Even recall when Trump, again, I'm not a Trump defender, he was the worst president we ever had. Recall when Trump said he was going to withdraw U.S. forces from Syria. Basically, the military itself, and I think the foreign policy establishment, refused to comply. So the military-industrial complex remains powerful, and bringing about any significant change in national security priorities is going to run right up into that. And ultimately, if there's going to be change, it's going to have to come from the American people. I mean, so we've lost 600,000 of our fellow citizens to the pandemic so far. Still people dying. It might going to get worse here. But as long as the American people are okay with the Pentagon spending, what, roughly $800 billion a year, while here at home we suffer the consequences of these viruses, as long as the American people are okay with that, then I would say there's probably not going to be any significant change. If the American people say, no, the fires in the Pacific are unacceptable. That rampant disease that kills
thousands and thousands. That's unacceptable. That we have to be better prepared for these challenges. We can't pick up the paper and find out that hospitals don't have the necessary material to respond to these emergencies. And unless the American people say that's not acceptable, then I think the status quo probably continues.
Andrew Bacevich is a retired Army colonel and president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. His latest book is After the Apocalypse, America's Role in a World Transformed. I spoke with him back in July. Coming up next on Top of Mind Prime Cuts, the problem of toxic workplace culture. It's good to have you with us today for Top of Mind Prime Cuts. I'm Julie Rose. It's our director's cut of the show. Happens once a week. Some experts are calling this pandemic time in the United States the Great Resignation. Lockdowns and remote working made many workers realize they wanted to and they could quit their jobs. They didn't want to go back to the office, which makes sense when a quarter of Americans dread going to work each day. Now, that's different from wishing you could be off doing something else. Dread implies something is rotten at work. The Society for Human Resource Management, SHRM, has surveyed American workers, and the findings suggest that lots of businesses are struggling with a toxic culture that alienates employees. Johnny C. Taylor Jr. is the president and CEO of SHRM, and we spoke back in 2019, just a few months before the pandemic kicked in. I don't dread going to work. I guess I'm one of the lucky ones.
That's right. You are.
What is it that makes people dread going to work in this way that's different from, you know, oh, I wish I could take the day off?
Well, there are a couple of things. One, when people speak to toxicity in the workplace, those are individuals who literally are oftentimes being sexually harassed. They're being bullied in the workplace. They're being discriminated against on the basis of age or race or national origin. And that's where it gets to the point where it's just not acceptable. But then there's another significant part of the population that says, I simply don't feel respected and valued. Like, I come here and I might as well be a robot. They've taken the human out of human resources and I'm not treated that way. And so this toxicity essentially makes it not, it's something I dread do. I do it because I have to. I'm not independently wealthy, but I don't like it.
And that sounds like two, let's break that down further in those two separate categories that create toxicity in the workplace. On the one hand, you said sexual harassment or discrimination based on age. Is that problem increasing? We're in this Me Too era, as it's called. Are we seeing, is that something is changing, that there's more of this kind of stuff causing toxicity, or maybe just more people are speaking out about it?
Yeah, I think it's the latter. I don't know that more people are engaging in the behavior, but more people are now aware of it. And we've raised and heightened the awareness of what is inappropriate workplace behavior, illegal behavior. And so as a result, we have seen over the last 2 years an uptick, our research says, in sexual harassment filings, for example. So absolutely, we're not able to say there's more activity. What we know is more people are aware of it. And that's a good thing because we can only do something about situations that we're aware of.
And on the other front, you described people who don't feel inspired, don't feel appreciated.
Yes. And no, it goes deeper than that. They're saying, I don't feel respected. I mean, at a very base level, imagine coming to the office during the day, and I'm sure members of your listening audience, your boss walks past you without saying hello. That can be such a downer and create a level of toxicity that we've never really talked about. Technically, does that person have to say hello to you? No. But let me tell you what that feels like on a day-to-day basis when you're giving this organization your all. Our research tells us that the number one reason people leave the workplace is their manager. 58% said, I left my last job because of my manager.
Okay, so it's the manager's problem. Are the managers not being trained? Do they just not understand that these subtle microaggressions, maybe you could call them, are causing their employees to be demoralized?
Well, so we have two problems. One is we don't necessarily do a great job at picking people managers. We don't assess them properly. And so we think that just because someone's a great auditor, that they'll be a great manager of auditors. And so we promote people because of their technical competency, you know, in their subject matter expertise. And so that's a problem. You have some people who should never be people managers. But bigger than that, once you, the larger population is people who actually could be very good at it if companies invested in people management, if they taught them how to do it. So just because you're a good accountant doesn't mean you know how to be a good manager of accountants.
Is it possible that employees just have higher expectations today? I mean, I don't want to put this all on millennials, but
no,
I mean,
but
are
I
people demanding
right.
more? Like they don't want to just go to work and clock in and it's a contract and I do the work and you pay me. But like it also needs to feel good when I'm there.
Well, there's no question that we are seeing, this is a sign of the times, right? Without a question, now that we're seeing a growing percentage of the population be millennials and already Generation Z, they do have a different expectation. These are people who watched their family members be very loyal. Just the prior generation, Generation Y and Generation X, I'm sorry, those folks came to work, gave their best to their employer, and then the 2008 debacle, economic, you know, depression, recession hit, and a lot of those folks lost their jobs. A lot of them saw their sisters and brothers come back from college with a degree and debt, but no job, and had to live at home. As a result, it really has changed how they see the world. And so there's no doubt that culture is more important today than it was a decade ago. And it's only going to become more of an issue now. We also did something called a fulfillment index, which we went out and we asked employees in the top 20 cities to rank sort of how fulfilled they were. And what we learned was, yes, compensation matters, job security matters, but right behind those is flexibility, meaningful work, and morality. That's what people are looking for. And so it's just not enough to pay people well and assure them that they have 30 years, because by the way, you can't guarantee them, they don't believe you anymore, that they're always going to have job security. So they want fulfillment. So this is going to become an even bigger issue for employers going forward.
How does a company create a culture that offers every employee, from the person on the front lines all the way up to the C-suite, a sense of fulfillment?
Yeah, it's really, that's the million-dollar question, perhaps the $223 billion question as a fact, you know, fact of the matter. And what we're trying to do is we say, you know, people don't work for companies. It's interesting. You said, how does a company do this? Well, people don't work for companies. They work for managers. And that's why companies need to invest a much better job at investing in people managers. If you have a span of control or 10 or 12 people, you're a supervisor, you should be able to know what motivates each one of your employees and what demotivates them. You should be able to understand what's good culture for them and to deliver on that. No, if you're a 50,000 person company, no CEO should be held accountable for that. But that's why we say it comes down to people managers.
And if you're an employee who doesn't feel, you know, respected or fulfilled at work, is there anything you can do? You know, you're not a manager. Do you confront your boss? That might lead to backlash. Do you go to HR? That might be bad. I guess you could look for a new job, but you never know if you're going to find a better spot, right? What do you do?
You know, you just put it in order, but I'm going to put a more positive spin. A lot of, I mean, we know from our research, most people don't want to be bad people managers. They want to be liked. So a lot of times people are just unaware. I am unaware of how I'm being perceived by my employees and what I could do to make things better. But if that doesn't work, if you don't trust your manager and you have good reason not to, HR is there. There's a huge misperception that HR just represents management. The reality is we can't do anything about a workplace culture if we're not aware of it. So not telling HR, we often say in sort of national security terms, you have to see something, say something so we can do something. Well, if we don't know about it, there's nothing we can do. And lastly, someone should be forced to leave their job. And that's what's happening. People are voting with their feet. And we know that really talented people are leaving organizations because culture is not right.
That's Johnny C. Taylor, president and CEO of SHRM, the Society for Human Resource Management. We spoke back in the fall of 2019. And that's it for Top of Mind Prime Cuts. It's been great having you with us today. Top of Mind is a production of BYU Radio. Cleon Wall, Ciara Hewlett, and Kyle Riemann produced the show. We'd love to have you connect with us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at BYU Top of Mind. You can find all of our past archives and more information about the show at byuradio.org/topofmind. I'm Julie Rose. We'll talk soon.